God, or you offended a fellow community member, you took steps to repair that relationship. You did an offering. You paid them back. You did something at your personal cost to repair the relationship. And sometimes you just strengthened it. Sometimes you partied. You either made an expression toward God, a burnt offering, and you strengthened your relationship by taking an act of commitment to God, just saying yes to God. Or you celebrated with a peace offering and you brought all the community together and you partied and built positive social experiences. So sacrifice was with repairing and strengthening good relationships. Redemption, what we're studying now, is about destroying abusive relationships where somebody is out to get you. It's either you or somebody else that's out to get you. So this is really a freedom motif. And let's go to before the Lord in prayer as we look into this today. Father, we come to you recognizing the provision that you have made for the real aspects of our lives with somehow this thing that happened 2,000 years ago, that the death of your Son on the cross and the subsequent resurrection somehow unleashed forces in history and in our lives that allow us to rebuild and repair and strengthen relationships as well as to escape from abusive ones and transform our state of health in those kind of situations. We ask that you would open our hearts today as we look into what your Son did in love, that we could understand the background and the context of that in the Old Testament. Teach us to see your heart as displayed in his life, his face, and his words, and his work on the cross. For his sake, amen. Okay, so what we started on this a couple weeks ago was we looked at the background of redemption. Remember, redemption was this word that sort of meant rescue, but you had to pay something. It's sort of like bail bonds, paying bail to get somebody out of jail, but you really got all the way out of jail in this. And we looked through background passages in the ancient Near East. We looked at there were certain things that the ancient Near East, everybody has a word for rescue. Just about everybody's got a word for rescue in every language because we are people that are always needing rescuing. Okay, but there was a special word that the Israelites had, this word goel, that was called a kinsman redeemer. It was blood ties. It was somebody in your tribe or your clan or somebody that had shared life with you and would come and bail you out, that would come and help you out if you got into a bad spot, if you got into an oppressive situation. They would stop what they were doing and they would exercise that kinship commitment that they had to you. And this was the Goel Redeemer. And more often than not, the picture of God to the Israelites in the Old Testament, when they use the word redeem, it's this Goel Redeemer. He's somehow related to the Israelites as the head of community. We got in on page 2 on the Old Testament, and we looked at the different kinds of things that needed redeeming, needed buying back. We looked at houses. So we looked at lands. If I got poverty-stricken to the point that I needed to, I couldn't even feed myself or my family, I could go to another Israelite and sell myself as an indentured servant. I could say, can you put me up, and I'll work for room and board, basically. I'll work for room and board. Here are my skill sets. You can use me for this, that, this, whatever. Here's what I'm good at. And you do room and board. And I'll have to move away from my home because I can't afford my mortgage payments. And you either get my home or you get my, you know, my family and my choices and things of this type. An indentured servant model that we would have. Well, if my brother was doing well, he could come over and buy me back. He could pay what that person would have gotten in terms of labor, pay my wages, and then take me home. And I'm back where I belong. And so there were a number of things that we looked at that you would, that belonged to somebody else, that were given to somebody else, and that you would go and redeem with a payment. You'd go make a payment. There was a special category that we looked at on page 3, the blood redeemer. The blood redeemer was where the payment that was made to right something, to reestablish community balance, was an act of judgment. It took effort. It took, you had to leave what you were doing. You had to abandon your work. You may have had to travel all the way across Israel to do this, to write this. It was an element of judgment. So it was legal action. Sometimes the payment was easy, it was money. Sometimes it was with labor. Sometimes it was with personal risk. If you had to go and execute somebody, there's a good chance they might fight back, depending upon on circumstances in which there was an element of risk associated with it. But it was still something that had to be done by somebody that was a kinsman. Then we started looking at page 4, and we got into God as Redeemer. Most of the work, if I went into an Israelite board meeting, so I go out, I go walk outside the gate, and there the elders are sitting around there at the gate. They're making legal deals. They're witnessing transactions. They're doing community business. It's like the little court. It's also a market. They do a lot of stuff right there at the gates where the elders have an almost perpetual assembly, except during siesta time. If I go there and I just say, redeem, they're going to think immediately somebody wants to buy something. See, the word redemption was not a religious word in that context. It was an economic word. It was a buying and selling word. So if I just said redeem with no subject and object, they would say, okay, what do you want to buy? And how much? And how did I get it to begin with? Almost like the Lambert sent me the Earls for the pawn shop, where I put something in hock that, you know, I needed money, and so I sold something that was an heirloom. At least that's how I told them it was an heirloom, right? You put this in hock, right? And then you go and redeem it. Right? You go buy it back in cases when it's yours. And in this, redeem was an economic word, but it obviously got applied because a lot of reality is set up for God to use in communicating to us. If you think about so many of the relationships that we have in life, you think, why does that exist? And somehow or another, it communicates something to us about the way God is. There are things, especially personal relationships. And in the economic sphere, this was something that made perfect sense to the Israelite. So we started there that God was used as a redeemer, where I said redeem, and somebody says, who's going to redeem? God. Remember, normally it could just be a normal human buyer, but this was God as a redeemer. We looked at the kinds of things that the Israelite would ask God to redeem them from. We looked at enemies, the wicked, oppressors, death in the grave, and legitimate punishment for sin. And if you notice there's a gradation there between consequences that I'm going to get. I'm in some situation where the consequences are abusive, and I don't deserve them. I've been captured. I'm a POW. I've been, my property's been confiscated by somebody through an illegal action in the courts. They've overpowered me and have abused me. Then on the spectrum over here on the far right, I've got the cases where it's completely legitimate. I've done something seriously wrong and deserve exactly what I get. And I ask God, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, I've learned my lesson, will you soften the consequences? So here it's, I didn't deserve it at all, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Here was, I deserve every bit of it, and most of the cases are right here in the middle where I've messed up my own life enough that I've had to sell myself or my property or whatever, and I've gotten myself in the pickle of a fix, as we would say. Okay, and so a lot of the cases are right here in the middle where we've got a combination of opportunistic types and mismanagement on my part. Okay. And so I think about I wrote a piece on the tank and recently, and I was thinking about this, that, you know, I don't have enemies in my life. I don't have oppressors. You know, I don't have a lot of people after me or spiritual forces against me because I do a good enough job myself of keeping myself in a mess. And I can see the enemy having a strategy session where he says, well, you know, there's nothing we could do any better than what Glenn's doing to himself. We'll just improve the situation if we get involved here. So let's leave him alone. Let him just muddle around in this thing, right? And so most of the redemption stuff occurs right here in the middle. It's where you realize that you've made some bad choices and you need some help out of them. But they're not so disastrous. And it's not a matter of, even in some cases, self-abusive behavior and self-destructive behavior, which we'll look at. So it's all over this map, but there's something that needs to be broken there, some kind of relationship to where I am now under somebody else's authority or somebody else's dominion, and it's a bad one. It's a bad one. There are abusive consequences. And the part God as the individual, so the individual Israelite would ask God, redeem me. In other words, rescue me, invest something, come after me out of your relationship with me and give me some kind of freedom, a relief from this situation. We started in last week on the Exodus. The Exodus was the big one. This is a national redemption. This is where God goes into Israel. Israel is in hard labor slavery, not indentured servitude, not a servitude to enhance one's status or to enhance the status of the of your family, as would occur in high levels of government. But this is one where I'm abused. I am what one of the Egyptian sources uses the phrase the vile Asiatic. And he's talking about the people of Palestine, basically. That was the Asiatics to the Egyptians, were the people from just the northerners of them, basically, people from the north. And they despised them. Remember in the Exodus story, they made them live separately because they were shepherds. And part of it also was an ethnicity thing about being Asiatic instead of Egyptian. And in the Exodus, it's a very abusive scenario. Egypt is threatened internationally at this particular time. By the Hyksos, we think, generally speaking, that we think that that's part of what's going on. Huge amount of paranoia. There have been internal defections in Egypt's history where large groups of people have defected to the enemy from inside like traitors and weakened Egypt's ability to deal with it. So you got foes without and foes within. And so the Pharaoh that comes up that does not know, that knew not Joseph, sits there and sees he's got a million or two to maybe as Howard as 3 million foreigners living in this land that they're dependent upon that are related, looks like, to the Hyksos that are out there at the borders threatening them and saying, that's all it would take, would be a defection here, and we're doomed. We're doomed. So we're going to have to be abusive and exert extra demand, control powers, oppression on these people to keep them in line, or we're going to be sunk as a nation. And Egypt is actually weakening in this time internationally as well. And so you get this very oppressive situation. Israel cries out to God, and God says, okay, it's time. Click, click. Your descendants will be in the land of Egypt for 400 years. It's time. Click. The iniquity of the Amorites are full. Everything comes together in the providence of God. Let's cut it off. Flip the switch. Exodus starts. God redeems his people, buys them out. They're in servitude. And it's bad servitude. It's abusive. They don't like it. It wasn't what they signed up for when they went to Egypt, okay, at all. And in this scenario, God goes in and bears his holy arm and rips them out. Fight, okay? We looked at, in that act, that somehow or another, this was called redemption. It wasn't called just rescue. It had somehow a notion of price in it. That somehow God paid. And we looked at a couple of scholarly quotes that said, we ended on the last one about the effort is regarded as the price, which gives point to the metaphor. Yahweh's action is at a cost to himself. Now, on this side of the cross, we don't have a lot of idea as to why that would be costly for God. A God of infinite power, the nations are as dust, no big deal. Why would the exercise of the Exodus and the plagues and the destruction of all this stuff be at a cost to Yahweh? We don't see the internal implications of that on perhaps the heart of God. When you come full scale to the New Testament and you sit there and see his son up on the cross, you understand a little bit more about perhaps that there are dimensions of effect on the heart of God that we weren't exposed to in the Old Testament. Later in the Old Testament, we get a glimpse. Let's say, fortunately you aren't, but let's pretend for a second that you're God. Okay, let's pretend for a second. And you're going to destroy tons of livestock, firstborn people. You're going to do a lot of damage in the land of Egypt. Okay, now, let's say you're also the person that writes in Ezekiel, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. I don't like judgment is my strange work, he says in Isaiah. I don't like to do this. Okay? But you have to do this to redeem your people Israel. Right? You have to intercede. You have to break in. Is it at a cost to yourself? Yeah. Yeah. You look at every one of them? Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a cost associated with this. You would not know this, like I say, in the individual act itself. You know, but when God reveals his heart through the rest of Revelation, and when you finally look at the cross and you say, what did it cost to redeem us there? Right? He bared his holy arm, but his holy arm was his son Jesus, right? Then you get a glimpse that judgment is just a strange work. Remember we talked about last time about the asymmetry between his judgment and his grace and his mercy and his care. I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that they should turn and live. He's pleading all the way through history with us. He said that don't do this. Don't go here. Why are you trying to drink from empty wells? There's no water there. It's dirt. It's dusty. I got living water here. I got food in abundance. I got bread. And you're sitting there trying to eat rocks and drink dust. Why would you do this? What have I done, oh Israel, that you have not done this? And so there is an element of cost associated with judgment on the part of God. There's a cost to this. And when we move into the next one, as we move into the New Testament, it becomes clearer and clearer that this stuff is deep inside the heart of God somehow. Now, the restoration from exile is number three here, which is new material. We won't get to audience participation, by the way, at this rate. Just to let you know. So you're safe there for those of you that were intimidated by the notion of audience participation. Right? Restoration from the exile. The resurrection from the exile. If you remember in history, here's what happens. Remember, they get called out of Egypt. They come into the land. And God says, now look, I'm driving out these people in front of you. You know, they are really bad. They're doing all kinds of really horrible stuff. Child sacrifice, cultic prostitution, all this really stuff that we don't want to talk about on Sunday. They do this religiously and deliberately. It's not a slip-up. They practice this as a religion. So I'm going to evict them from the land, push them north basically to Phoenicia, and plant you in there. But let me warn you, if you do the same thing, guess what? I am very fair. I will push you out of the land too. I will push you out, and sure as the world, guess what happens? Right? We do it. Pushes us out into what's called exile. Pushes us over into Babylon. Pushes some of us into Syria and various places, none of which include the United States. Okay, let's be clear on this. Okay. Okay. But the Southern Kingdom, for those of you that catch that, right? Okay. The Southern Kingdom, he pushes over into basically into Babylon. But he says, I'm going to bring you back because you're going to learn your lesson. I'm not going to abandon you there. I'm not going to kill you off. I'm going to teach you something. This is remedial work. Okay, 70 years, remedial work. I'm going to teach you not to be idolatrous. I'm going to teach you there is one God, and I'm going to teach you that you are going to be different from all people one way or another. One way or another, you're going to be different. And so I'm going to put you in that land, but I'm going to bring you back. And so the restoration, bringing them back into the land, is the restoration from the exile. And the verse here, one of the verses, there are tons of them, but in Isaiah 43, this is what the Lord says, your redeemer, that's a kinsman redeemer, I'm part of your community. I'm a community member within Israel. I'm the founding member. Me and Abraham put this together, okay, that covenant. But I'm a founding member, but I am still your kinsman, and I'm going to redeem. I'm going to buy you back somehow. Your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, for your sake I will send to Babylon and bring down as fugitives all the Babylonians in the ships in which they took pride. That's a judgment on Babylon. I am the Lord, your Holy One, Israel's Creator, your king. This is what the Lord says. He who made a way through the sea, that's a reference to what? Exodus. A path through the mighty waters, the parting of the Red Sea. Who drew out the chariots and the horses, that's Pharaoh's army. The army and the reinforcements together, and they lay there, never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. Forget the former things, do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the desert and streams in the wasteland. So God is saying, every time you get in trouble, you think about the Exodus. When Israel would ever get in trouble and they worried about God, whether God was going to help them, and individually, you could always fall back on the Exodus. That was your big miracle as a nation, because your nation would not have even existed without that. You may not have seen that personally, because you would have been a grandson of a grandson of a grandson of a grandson, whatever, okay? But the fact that you lived in a nation that was just plucked out of the middle of another one, you had no way of knowing where you came from. You said, how do I explain this? That looks like a good one to me. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense otherwise how I got here. And they would fall, but God says, nope, the day's coming where that's not where you look back to. You're going to start looking back to the restoration from the exile. Because I'm going to pluck you out of another nation that captured you by replacing its leadership. We're going to have management turnover. Okay? And we're going to fire all the CEO, and we're going to bring some new ones in, and they're going to let you go, and they're going to pay for you to go back, actually. They're going to pay for the rebuilding of your city. They're going to plug you in for all that good stuff. And that's what's new, and it's going to be based after that. So instead of streams in the water or a path through the water, it'll be streams in the desert and a way through the wasteland. Same kind of motif, freedom and Exodus. Rise and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth, for now you will go out from the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. From there you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. In other words, you're over there in the enemies, and the enemies have got you in their hand, and God's going to go over there and somehow rescue you with a cost, at some kind of cost. Yet their Redeemer, as the word Redeemer is strong, the Lord Almighty is His name, He will vigorously defend their cause. It's that effort, that involvement, that investment, action, so that He may bring rest to their land, but unrest to those who live in Babylon. Okay? In other words, I'm going to turn the tables on your oppressors. As part of my redemption, it's going to have a judgment component, and I'm going to flip it around. Those that are poor do better. And I'm going to flip your oppressors, become the oppressed. Okay? They go off in the ships in which they took proud and captured other peoples. For this said the Lord, you were sold for nothing, and you will be redeemed without money. Isaiah 53. This is the exception that proves the rule to redemption being money. Normally when you redeemed, you paid money, right? You cost something. The fact that he points out and says, I sold you for nothing. I didn't get anything out of sending you to the exile. I got zero for this. It wasn't an economic transaction. I didn't get anything, and so I'm not going to pay anything to get you back. See, it was the opposite from the way normal selling and buying worked, right? He said, you were sold, and I got nothing out of that deal, but I will get you back, Israel. Your heart, when you come back, you will fight from their own about idolatry, so much so that when I appear in history in the person of my son, you're going to have a huge problem. Okay, that's how strong your Shema will be after we get through with this. That's how strong it will be. We won't have a problem with idolatry ever again in Israel's history, mainstream Judaism. So restoration from Israel, from exile was seen as a redemption, as God was going to go pluck them out again. And in this case, it wasn't going to cost money, but that was because it didn't involve any money moving in. And then the future, this eschatological means last things, right? Eschatological is that funny word. It just means last things. So the eschatological future to an Israelite in the Old Testament looked weird. It was very foggy. There were elements in it that they couldn't put together. And it's like the old, they use the illustration on us that are confused about it on this side of the New Testament, about two mountain peaks off in the distance. And when you're looking at it, you can't see the valley in between. You can't tell the distance between the two peaks, you know, and things of this type. You can't, on this, if you're pretty far away from it, you can't make a whole lot of decisions about what the land looks like. And Israel in the Old Testament had promises of the millennial kingdom when the Lord comes and returns and refurbishes the earth. There's the promises of a new heavens and new earth where he just, you know, wipes it all away and cranks it up, a brand spanking new one. There's a Messiah that comes in humiliation and is, you know, struck down, the pierced Messiah, the rejected king of Israel. And then there's the triumphant king that Israel accepts with open arms and subdues all the, you know, all these things are mixed in there together to the little Israelite that's looking there and trying to figure out how, we're going to put this together. And the rabbis try to do this, remember, you know, around the time of Jesus, they're working on how we're going to get a Jesus that rides in on a donkey and also comes on a white horse. You know, how are you going to do this? How are you going to come? One that comes in suffering, and they end up coming up with any number, a couple of different messiahs. Messiah ben Joseph, Messiah ben David. You know, if Israel is sinful, he'll come one way. If Israel is clean, he'll come another. You know, they do what we do in theology. You try to wrestle and try to put these things together into some coherent whole. But on that side, eschatological future included everything. So a lot of their verses, you have to go through, you know, and say, okay, which peak are we talking about on this side of the cross? We have a little bit more advantage because we're closer to the mountains, per se. So in the eschatological future, the first one, I will signal for them and gather them in. Surely I will redeem them. So in some future, in a future, God is going to redeem his people. They will be as numerous as before. Though I scatter them among the peoples, yet in distant lands they will remember me. They and their children will survive, and they will return. Okay? I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles. Now, this, by the way, is addressed to what's called the suffering servant. So this is Cyrus. This is the Messiah. This is the elect of Israel. In the Isaiah 42, there's what they call the servant songs. There's about 6 to 8 passages where you read it, and sometimes it looks like he's talking to a Messiah, an individual Israelite. Sometimes it looks like he's talking to good Israelites, the elect remnant they're called. Sometimes he's looking like he's talking to the whole nation. And you can't really tell. You have to look at it from, because sometimes it looks like the suffering servant is going to bear the sins of Israel, Isaiah 53. So it can't be identical to Israel, because he's doing this, he's righteous, and he's suffering for sinners. So there's a distinction there, but at the same time, he is representative somehow of the nation, like a king was. I mean, a king would represent the whole nation, per se. And in this, I, the Lord, have called you my suffering servant, my servant in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you. I will make you a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles. Now, in the New Testament, who is this applied to? Jesus, light to the Gentiles. Okay. To open eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those that sit in darkness. And who applied this to himself in the New Testament? Jesus. Remember, when John the Baptist gets thrown in jail. John the Baptist, Jesus' cousin, right? John the Baptist is baptizing, trying to get Israel clean, so when the Messiah would come, it would come in glory. And we could get on with the program. We could get on with the rule of Israel and universal peace and all the things that were supposed to happen when the Messiah came, right? John the Baptist sees Jesus and he says, you want me to baptize you? He knows who this is. He knows who this is. Even though he grew up with him, he knows exactly this is the Messiah. This is the Lamb of God that takes away. You know, didn't say this is my good cousin. This is the Son of God. This is major stuff. And so he did this and he expected this deliverance. And then, so, did Jesus usher in the reign of Israel? Not before John the Baptist was thrown into prison by the evil Roman Empire, right? And so John's about to be killed. He's captured here. And so you can imagine his confusion. He's baptized. He literally identified Jesus as the Lamb of God, right? Son of God, the King of Israel. And so you can imagine your faith would be challenged in that dungeon. And so he sends a messenger. He sends one of his disciples. Says, go ask Jesus, are you the one that was supposed to come? Are we supposed to wait for somebody else? Is there something I'm missing here in this picture? And when Jesus answered him, how did Jesus answer? He quoted from Isaiah. He said, go back and tell John what you've seen. The lame walk again, the blind receive their sight, liberty is preached unto the captives. And freedom is proclaimed to the individual captives. Okay? He sent him back with this passage. And the last verse of that passage that he quotes from in Isaiah 6 says to proclaim liberty to the captives. Let me see. Actually, I may have it here. Hold on. No, I don't have it here. Wait a minute. Hold the door. No, I don't, actually. He says all these good things about liberty of the captives, freedom, reversal of bad situations and circumstances, and to execute judgment upon the oppressors. It's the last clause of that verse. And when Jesus quotes that to the disciples to take back to John, tell him what you've seen, he leaves off that last half of the verse because it was not a time of judgment first. See, judgment's his strange work. God postpones that as long as he can. Peter says, the reason God has not stopped all this mess is that he's patient. He is not wanting any to perish. He's given us, well, one more day. I can salvage a few more. Maybe some other folks will open their heart to my warm love and let this get on with the program. You know, one more day, not today. I originally had it down on the calendar for today, but let's postpone it. Okay? This is the heart of God, right? And so when it goes back to the message back to John the Baptist was, no, we're not going to do it yet. We're not going to execute judgment yet. Okay? We're going to get this thing clear and do what we can. So, but his goal was to proclaim a liberty and a freedom. When the Lord returns to Zion, they will see it with their own eyes, burst into songs of joy together, you ruins of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. Now, it's an interesting thing about this phrase, bear his holy arm, because in the Exodus, you know, somewhere in the 7 to 10 time range, God is described plucking Israel out of that with an outstretched arm. He's reached out. It's like grabbing somebody by the scuff of the neck that's in trouble, falling over a precipice, or is caught in some pit, and then snatching them out with a strong arm. I remember when I first became a believer, when I first asked Christ to get involved in my life and influence my future, I had this Hollywood free paper from the Jesus people back in those days. That was the culture I was identified with in the 60s. And they had this picture that meant the most to me. It was night, there was a shepherd, and there's this little sheep caught in the brambles. Just struggling, is exhausted, can't get out, caught in the thorns, can't see anything, can't see but 14 feet, remember? But caught there, messed up, and you got the shepherd back in the sheepfold or where the other 99 sheep are, out at night when the wolves and all the felines are doing their best hunting. The shepherd is out there reaching out and grabbing little Glenn from the bramble bush, plucking him out, right? And this is the kind of thing that this future was about. This is what this kind of thing was a future about, was this strong arm, this reaching. What's different in this was that he was going to bear his holy arm. You did not bear holy things. You wore robes over those. When David sent messengers to a rival country in goodwill over the death of a family member in that country to insult these men, they cut their robes off and bared their legs. And he told those representatives, stay in Jerusalem until your beards have grown and get fresh clothing. You didn't bear holy things. It was an embarrassment. It was a sign of disgrace. It was a sign of humiliation to do this. Things were not right. So when he bared his holy arm in the future to do this, they would have said something's wrong, something's odd about this picture. But then when you look at the cross, wow, the humiliation, the scandal that God has been always given about that, when you think about it, he's constantly maligned as to why. The first critics of Christianity in the first 300 years, that's what they went after. A God, a good and powerful God, would not die as a Roman criminal in abject humiliation and disgrace. It's just contradictory to what we know about gods. Can't believe it. Can't go there. Right? So God dealt with slander and malignment all those times. Now, those were the big categories of redemption to the ancient Israelite. Let me just I've got a couple of observations about some of the different points of that. before we get into next week, the very structure of what redemption is, so we can start applying that. Observations. We're on page 7. Sometimes God redeems by legally prosecuting enemies and those who would steal land and orphans' fields. Sometimes the redemption is accompanied by bringing judgment on the enemies for violations of rights. God judged Egypt, and future redemption is linked to vengeance on the oppressors. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. Okay? What this was positive action on the part of God when somebody had no right to treat you like that. Okay? Nobody had any right to abuse these individuals. God would go do the legal action. Haul them into court, stop the proceedings, use military might if necessary to force them to work in the within the legal system or to suspend their abusive practices. And so there was an element of kinship to where there's vengeance with it. And vengeance is just nothing more than moral outrage we talked about last time, moral outrage. A vengeance notion is that there's something very, very out of balance, very, very out of balance, that sends wrong messages to the community, that will set precedents. This was part of the reason why God was so upset with the leadership of Israel when they would fall away from him first. When the king or the priest or the prophets would become compromised, when their ethics would be compromised, they'd become guilty of bribery or extortion or exploiting the rights of those with no powers in the community. God was so upset with them first, because if the kings go wrong, guess what happens to everybody else, right? This is what Proverbs tells us, right? If the king listens to lies, the whole nation goes that way, right? You set precedents, because even as slow as some of us are, if I see this is the way the system works, guess what? If I know those are what the rules, we constantly deal with this. With our friends, with our children, with our work associates sometimes, you know, they sit there and say, well, you have to do this to get ahead. This is the way the system works, see? And the hope and part of what redemption is about says, no, you don't. Boom, boom, boom. I'm going to break you out of that lockstep. There's no reason to be addicted to that. You can be there are plenty of things that we get addicted to. Some people get addicted to insecurity. Some get addicted to arrogance. Some get addicted to addictions. I mean, literally, there's all kinds of things that we become enslaved to, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes not. But in this particular case, God's going to redeem them by explicit legal action, judgment, in the cases where it's a violated right. The Goel, that kinsman redeemer, was still always the nearest adult male kinsman with the right and ability of redemption. Thus, God as Goel, at the very least, points to God's close relationship to Israel, probably as father or as husband. Okay. Now, actually, probably just means that those are used more. He also describes himself as a mother of Israel in Isaiah as well. And there's a possibility, depending upon how you exegete the passage, that he describes himself actually as the wife in Hosea. There's a passage in Malachi and one in Hosea, and I've got that discussion on the tank. But in terms of, since redemption was the male adult male responsibility to go do the vengeance thing, God is portrayed perhaps Goel on the basis of the fatherly or the husband relationship with Israel. It should be remembered that the enslavement of Israel by Egypt and other oppressions are not comparable to the indentured servitude of Leviticus 25. In the case of the indentured servant, that's where, remember, I was just in a bad way and I sold myself to an alien Israelite or an alien or another Israelite in Israel. The Redeemer has no animosity toward the temporary master of his kinsman, right? But rather has the duty to pay off the kinsman debt or hire. Thus, the conditions of Leviticus 25 are not mirrored in the concept of redemption from exile. So, I become poor. I go sell myself to an alien. My brother's doing okay. He got his quarterly bonus. And so he's going to come bail me out. He's going to come buy me and send, bring me back home. But there's no animosity between him and my particular employer, one that I sold myself to. So there's no real animosity there. Now, there could conceivably if I'm being abused or something, you know. But remember, I had generally choices to who I sold myself to. You know, I could go out on the auction market and say, hey, I'm a good skilled worker. What's your habit of how you treat other people that come to work for you for 6 years? Because remember, I was supposed to get freed in the seventh year, right? This is different in Egypt. No, I didn't have a choice about this, and they beat me up all the time. They beat me up all the time, right? So there's an element of judgment that you have done wrong, and I'm morally outraged at the way you have treated these people and my people, the kinsman part of them. It seems obvious that the divine redemption from Egyptian slavery in order to bring Israel to Canaan became the model for the return from the Babylonian exile. The most plausible socio-legal route for God's redemption of Israel, whether from Egyptian slavery, Babylonian exile, or anonymous oppressors in Israel, is the law of the blood redeemer. The Goel Hadam, blood redeemer, comes with a sword and fury to avenge his beloved relative, a portrait which is similar to the depiction of God as the redeeming, vengeful warrior in Isaiah. Now, at its core concept, all this means is that God is passionate about rescuing us. When you look at the global scheme of things, when you get back, when you peel back the curtains of the New Testament, and you look, if you ask Paul, says, who do we wrestle with? Do we wrestle with flesh and blood? No. What do you mean? That's all I see is flesh and blood. No, you don't catch it. You don't get it. We're part of a bigger picture. To use the phrase, we live in the Shire and we don't see Mordor. We don't see Mordor. We don't know about Sar. We don't know about these evil power things out there. We just mumble around. We're only about this tall. Okay? And what happens? What happens? When God goes to... And remember the 32 things we're going to talk about? Redemption, sacrifice. One of them is called victory over the principalities and powers. That's what the New Testament calls these invisible forces, influences, suprapersonal, that somehow affect our cultures, our leaders, some of our decisions, and are constantly after us to encourage us to compromise in the smallest matters. Like, say, in some cases they don't have to mess with you if you mess it up yourself enough. They just have to sort of give you some rope to hang yourself, you know. But in some cases, in many cases, there's a violent opposition going on here. And so what you see at the cross is an act of violence. It's a violence of love that sat there and said, I took them on, I disarmed them. I literally took all their weapons of the sin and the law and guilt and the inexorable consequences of law. Remember that consequence engine? I plug this in, I get this out all the time. I plug in sin, guess what I get? Death. In all its forms. Personal decay, broken relationships, abject hopelessness, you know. Death has many faces, many, many faces, right? You plug it in and God says, yep, snip. It was a costly snip. Cost a lot. Costly snip, but he snipped. That consequence engine does not have to proceed, right? Disarm the rulers and authorities. And it was with a vengeance. It was with a passion for his folks. The kinsman redeemer was passionate about the kinsman. Okay. He just wasn't into the killing thing. That wasn't, you didn't get to do it enough in Israel to really get into that. Okay. And this was a fellow Israelite in many, many cases, and there's all kinds of dynamics associated with that. But there was a strong sense, a strong passion on the part of God to redeem his people. The next one, all socio-legal cases of Goel, with the exception of cultic offerings, and that means just the sacrifices, there were sacrifices you could backpack, concern an impoverished Israelite or one who is severely abused, requiring the intervention of the blood redeemer. It is a logical step to include all the deprived members of society, Thus, it is not surprising that God is portrayed as the redeemer of the oppressed, the widow, the stranger, and the poor. And there's a string of verses that show that. God had solidarity with the marginalized in Israel. And outside of Israel, actually. Remember, Israel was the only nation, I pointed out a couple weeks ago, that if there was a runaway slave that had been abused by their master in Mesopotamia, and they ran to Israel, Israel was not allowed to turn them back over to the master. And as a matter of fact, they were given rights to live anywhere in the land they wanted to. This is so counter everything of the day, and the ethos and the pathos, I might say, of the present, to give that level of freedom and acceptance to somebody that's so abused or marginalized. Right? This is a precedent-setting thing, right? And so God was the one that tried to influence the laws and would act decisively in some cases to attempt to give social justice to the widow, the orphan, those that had no rights or those that had no means to assert their rights and defend themselves in law courts. Right? It gets really bad toward the close of the Old Testament. The social abuses get worse and worse. And like I say, if Israel had been had Israel leadership not been so oppressive, perhaps the prophets could have used more of their message on the future, prophetic things, than on ripping the faces off of the kings and the prophets that were so bad, and we wouldn't be quite as confused about the end times if they had been able to spend more of the Bible on future events. Right? But they had to try to correct the religious elite and the government elite to try to help people like Glenn. Okay, people like Glenn. And finally, ultimately, the association of God's redemption with rescue and mercy gives the individual hope that God will redeem one from punishment for sin and even from death. Remember, in the Old Testament, they're not sure what's going to happen on the other side of death. God hasn't been working on that. He's been trying to teach them something different about this side of life, this side of death. Okay? He's been working on that, how to avoid death now, so to speak. Okay? But the Israelite knew, the Israelite somehow knew that God's, His love endures forever. His love endures forever. And there's a conflict between His love endures forever and I'm going to die here. And His love stops there and I go be the shady thing down in the underworld, which is they sell. And so, although they don't get really, really clear on this until later in the Old Testament, they would sit there and say, well, I reach one conclusion. I'm not going to stay dead somehow. I mean, for God to be faithful and loyal to His covenant to me, He's going to have to do something because it can't stop there. And so the Israelite would understand that God not only would redeem me from the consequences of my sin, that when I went and I confessed, which just means agree with, say the same thing as, you know, I said I agree with God. You know, if you were like me, I grew up in a group where confession was very ritualized, and you had a little certain prayers you prayed and things of this type. And it took me years to be reprogrammed to where it wasn't sitting there and beating myself up about this thing, but it was simply a matter of being honest with God and said, "You're right, I'm wrong. I agree with you that this is destructive, and I did it. And you're right, it's destructive, and I agree with you. It's wrong. I've embarrassed us, and I'm sorry, Father." And so confession for the Israelite that was the key to, again, getting forgiveness and understanding this and moving that relationship forward was linked here with a broken consequence engine, that snip thing. And ultimately from death, that somehow sin that which produced death was going to somehow be rendered powerless. And that death which had sting was going to have no more sting. That somehow I was going to be reunited with those that I knew, those that I fellowshipped with, that I saw in the temple every Sunday, every Saturday, okay, back in those days. And that death had no ultimate victory in this kind of thing. Because nothing could stand against Yahweh. Nothing could stand against Yahweh. Well, we didn't get to the audience participation. But instead, you can pray for me this week. What we have seen, and we're starting to see a picture that redemption has to do with breaking of abusive relationships, destruction of relationships, weakening it, taking a change of state, change of state. Once we get out of the bad one into the good one, then we can move over to repairing those relationships and strengthening those relationships. But there's got to be an exit, see, before you start enjoying the land of Palestine, before you get into the conquest and consolidation thing. There's got to be that exit. Something's got to come get us out of our individual situations, life, individual situations of events, and many times from our own heart, people of us that we wander into brambles ourselves. They look like they're tasty, and we just get over them, we find out they're not. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that you bared your holy arm, that you broke into history. We are amazed at how different that looked than what we would have perhaps expected with a triumphant military intervention on the white horse that eventually will come. But we didn't sort of expect it to model humility to us, model love, model gentleness, model patience, teaching us that you have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. We just pray that we would understand this, that the passionate heart that you had to rescue us is there for us every day, that you are passionate about us, that your warmth in your heart, that your kindness is an aggressive thing. It's not passive. We don't seek you out. You chase after us to bless us, and that we might just stop drinking at dry wells, and that we would go drink the living water, that we would draw close to you and open our hearts, and in our confusion that we would invite you into our lives, into our decisions, into our relationships, not even knowing what that fully means, but that we would open our lives to you more and more because of the love that you showed us in the person of your Son and the power of his work. We pray that we would grow in appreciation for that work as well, and that we could see your heart in that face and in that act of love in the person of your Son. Bring us back safely together again next week. Help us reflect upon these things and draw closer to your warm heart this week. Amen.